Alice O'Sullivan, guest host for the Your Legal Rights program, in for Chuck Finney, who's taking the evening off. My guest tonight, as you heard, is J. Antonio Nieres. Mr. Nieres is a member of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar and is a specialist in immigration and nationality law, certified by the Board of Legal Specialization. His law offices are in Burlingame. Welcome, Tony, to the program.
Good evening, Alice. Good to be here.
The topic tonight that Mr. Nieres is going to be discussing is the Deferred Action Childhood Arrival Program. This evening's program is funded by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, by the Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar, by the Labor and Employment Section of the State Bar, and by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. So, Tony, tell me a little bit about this Deferred Action Program. What is it all about?
Yes, Alice. This program called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the acronym, of course, because lawyers love acronyms, is DACA, is a program that will grant the immigration benefit called deferred action for young people who are here in the United States unlawfully. These are the same people who have been called dreamers because of the Dream Act that was pending in Congress, which failed to become law. But in a move by the Executive Department, they decided that they would delay or postpone action to deport a person who was not in lawful immigration status. So this is a temporary program that defers any enforcement action against people who are otherwise removable or deportable.
And who's eligible for this program?
Well, the eligibility requirement is really you had to have come to the United States before you were 16 years old. You've lived in the United States continuously since June 15, 2007 or earlier. You were physically present in the United States on June 15, 2012. And at that time, you request for deferred action. You're currently in school or have graduated from high school, obtained a general education certificate, or have served in the United States Armed Forces, or were honorably discharged. You were under the age of 31 on June 15, 2012. June 15th is the date that this executive order was signed, and so this is for laws. This would have been the effective date of the program.
And what does the program give you?
It really gives the person who applies for consideration of deferred action the opportunity to ask for employment authorization. In other words, a work permit. So if granted, this would give the individual not only a sense that the government will not actively look for him in order to try to deport him, but will also provide him with the employment authorization document that allows him to work lawfully. If you remember, the Dream Act spoke about the idealism of young people, of the desire of young people to enter the job force and make positive contributions to the society. And this is actually a mechanism by which that particular intent is given life, that the person who wants to work lawfully, I mean, who wants to work and provide provide a positive impact on the community, will be given that opportunity.
It strikes me that the type of people who are eligible to apply are the very kind of people that we would want to have here.
That's correct, Alice. You know, I think the program, the DACA, or this Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, is a program to give the benefit to these people and at the same time actively seek the approval of Congress for legislation that will fix this otherwise a broken immigration system. Hopefully, the congressional result would be to try to provide further benefits to these people. But at this particular juncture, the idea is that these young people are now going to be able to work lawfully and contribute to the society.
So if someone is in second grade and applies, what benefit do they get at that point?
Well, you have to be at least 15 years of age when you apply. So
it's very limited.
Yes, it's limited to young people who are otherwise qualified for this program. As I said, they will be assured that there's not going to be any active enforcement against them in order to try to deport them. And at the same time, they're given the employment authorization document that gives them the opportunity to work lawfully. May I add that when you're able to work lawfully, it necessarily implies that you're able to obtain a social security number, because you're going to be working and your wages would be reported to Social Security as well.
So we would get the benefit then of people contributing to the Social Security, these people contributing who otherwise would not contribute. Is that
correct?
That's
fair. Yes, that's correct. That's very true.
And I assume there would be other... I have a question. For example, the person who's a student, 16, 17, 18, they can go on to graduate school or college, something like that, and remain in the program?
Yes, if they're given the deferred action, their status would be... it would mean that they would be reassured that no active enforcement procedures would be taken against them, because they're the benefit of the Deferred Action Program. If they have the work authorization, but if they choose to go to school to further their studies, in other words, go to college or to university, that's very possible. However, the grant of the deferred action may not necessarily mean that certain benefits otherwise given to lawful residents would be given. In other words, I'm speaking particularly of student loans, Alice. This, because students, there's a determination that they're you need some lawful presence here in the United States in order to obtain student loans. The beneficiary of deferred action, while arguably is some sort of immigration status, it may not translate into eligibility for purposes of student loans. I think there had been a finding that, in fact, it does not, and that student loans would not be available to persons who are in deferred action.
What about health insurance?
That's the same determination as well, Alice, that they're not eligible for health insurance, at least not under the fact that they've become recipient of a deferred action grant.
And one thing that comes to mind, what about a driver's license?
Well, driver's license is particularly determined by the different states. And it's not yet clear, unfortunately, whether or not if you have deferred action, you would be entitled to obtain a driver's license. Now, some states have already categorically indicated that deferred action would not mean that you would be eligible to obtain a driver's license in that particular state. Other states, it's not yet as set. There's argument to be made that deferred action is a deferred status, which actually provides some sort of presence or legal presence here in the United States, which would allow a person to obtain a driver's license in his particular home state. Because if you have been granted deferred action and you have employment authorization, you're able to obtain a social security number. That social security number should be sufficient for the purpose of obtaining a driver's license. But this is not yet clear, and it has not yet been established. Unfortunately, the program, while we've been told by the Department of Homeland Security that the initial batch of applications, approved applications, would be coming out very soon, they've not yet come out. And so this is almost playing it by ear, because we don't know yet how far or how much other benefits can come with the grant of deferred action.
So this is really a timely topic, because we're right on the edge of what's going on.
Absolutely,
here.
This is that's true, Alice. That's very true.
When were these applications first accepted? How long has this been going on?
Well, the first applications were accepted August 15th, 2012, and so it's just a little over a month since the time that the first applications were submitted. The numbers, Alice, are particularly staggering. I mean, there have been estimates that there are over a million individuals who are part of the pool of people who are eligible to ask for deferred action. Over a million individuals. The initial filings went over 70,000 in that 30-day period.
Just so, since August 15th, there have
correct.
Been 72,000?
Yes.
Oh, my.
Yeah. You know, Alice, this points, at least for me, it points to the fact that the immigration system has neglected this particular segment of the society. It's unfortunate because there had been moves in the past, and I'm referring specifically to the DREAM Act, which would have addressed this particular problem already. But unfortunately, it didn't muster enough votes in Congress, and therefore it was way late. However, the executive department, through the president, has actually spearheaded this this initiative in order to again acknowledge the fact that there is a great problem that needs to be solved, and that this particular segment of the undocumented population should be given immediate benefit because you're young only one time, I guess.
Well, and it strikes me that, as we mentioned earlier in the program, these are people that we that are the kind of people that we want here, the kind of people we want to contribute to our society, the very kinds of people that we should have a program for.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly with you, Alice. There are some factors now that are of particular concern to the possible applicants as well as to their families. And the one big factor, of course, is that, you know, the applicant will be revealing himself to the government. He will be indicating his identity, his age, where he lives. And there's always a fear of maybe the same information that you're giving to the government is the information that they will use in order to go after you because of your illegal status. And this is a concern not only for the applicant, but also for their families, their parents in particular, who probably would not have any lawful status as well.
So at this point, there really is no assurance one can give, or what are your thoughts about that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in order for this kind of program to become successful, there has to be some confidentiality involved. I mean, you can't ask the circumstances of people and then use that same information to go after them. And I think that the numbers will have to support this. In other words, I don't think 72,000 applications in the initial month is really going to be the bulk of the number of applications that you're going to see. I think a lot of people are waiting and seeing whether or not the government is actually going to favorably adjudicate those considerations for deferred action. They're waiting to make sure that it's not a trick in order for the government to be able to go after undocumented individuals.
These individuals are not in a high priority group, are they?
No, precisely. This program was initiated. These are students. There's no criminal record for any of the students. They're really low priority aliens. But the whole idea, of course, is that the executive department must enforce the laws, and the law indicates that if you have unlawful status, there has to be, or there should be, enforcement mechanisms to try to take you in and try to obtain a removal or deportation order against you.
What is your own personal experience about dealing with these applications? I understand you did some pro tem work.
Yes. Thank you for mentioning that, Alice. I did work with, because a lot of these applications are reviewed, or there have been consultations done by legal services organizations, and I wanted to make note of the Community Legal Services of East Palo Alto, which had a consultation and application review session just last week. My impressions were that the people who exhibited some distrust would be the parents of these applicants for deferred action. In other words, it's the older generation that's wary of what the program asks for and what the program is actually promising. On the other hand, the applicants themselves, the students or the young individuals, are very eager to try to accumulate and to collate all the necessary supporting documents to establish their eligibility for the benefit that they're seeking. They're very idealistic that they want to get work permits in order to contribute to the society, to help their parents who have been providing for them all through these years, and to actually become self-sufficient and independent, so that they don't have to continually depend on their parents for their own lives.
And so what you're seeing then in the face of the applicant is really the dreamers. You're seeing the dreamers there.
That's correct. That's correct, Alice. These are the dreamers, and it's very inspiring, I have to say, that these young people recognize that this is a benefit that gives them that opportunity to contribute to the society and contribute to their families.
And that's what they're looking for. That's what they're looking forward to doing. Yes.
That's correct, yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
I thought if we just took a look at this, the requirement, the form, there's a form one fills out if one is applying for this?
Yes. It's called the Consideration of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And this is a form that the Citizenship and Immigration Services have formulated. It's a very basic form. It asks about the individual's identity, and of course you'd have to establish that through either birth certificate, birth record, and or a copy of the passport. And it asks your mailing address, which is very important because this is the way that the government will be communicating with the person. It also asks for the addresses that the person has lived for since the time that he entered the United States. And this is one area where the young applicant would be insistent on the parents to try and remember what the address we lived,
yes,
you know, 7 or 8 years ago. This is really for completion of the information that that the government requests. It asks about educational information, because the big thing here is that you should be currently in school or have obtained a high school diploma or obtained a GED or served in the armed forces or have been honorably discharged.
So let's go over that one more time. You have to be 16 years old.
Yes, to apply.
And
you had to currently in school.
Okay.
Or graduated from high school or obtained a GED or was honorably discharged from the armed forces. Or currently in the armed forces, this particular area is going to be established generally by school transcripts or a certification from the school that, yes, this person is currently enrolled.
And you cannot be 31?
You cannot be more than 31 years of age at the time of... on June 15, 2012.
And that date is important because that's the date it was deferred action program was signed.
Signed, yes. And they provided for an initial application period, for the first applications to be received by August 15.
And one of the things you mentioned was the person had to be here continuously for 5 years following June 15th, 2007.
Right.
So that would be 5 years as of June 15th, 2012, obviously.
That's correct. And this is, again, the best indication of this would be transcripts from the schools. So you'd be looking at middle school transcripts and high school transcripts. And this is important that it establish a continuity of residence. That's very important because while certain absences may be excused, generally you don't want to have left the United States.
When we come back after this portion of the program, I want to discuss how one establishes you're here on any given date. The June 15th, 2012 date,
Practical advice.
There you go.
Okay.
Absolutely. I'm Alice O'Sullivan, guest host for Chuck Finney on the Your Legal Rights program. Funding has been provided for this portion of the program by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, by Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar, by Labor and Employment Section of the State Bar, and by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of the San Francisco. I have a real special note from our program engineer, Joanne Marr, who has a message for you.
And here I am with my dog, Rover. He's prominently featured on the Burglar Deterrent Home Protection CD, which we're making available for your pledges of support. $75 will get you this CD at 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917, or you can make your pledge online at KALW.org. This CD contains a variety of sound effects like the one you're just hearing. Sound effects of ordinary household sounds like running water, people talking loudly and walking around, doors opening and shutting. You can put your CD player on repeat, and it'll deter burglars from breaking in while you're away. Yours for a pledge of $75. Pledge your support to your legal rights at 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917, or you can make your pledge online at KALW.org. Our goal for this hour of Your Legal Rights is six pledges, six of you, picking up your phones and calling 800-525-9917 or making your pledge online at KALW.org. Pledge in support of Chuck Finney, who's been tirelessly hosting Your Legal Rights for the last 25 years. If you've got something of value from this program, maybe some useful advice from our panel of volunteer attorneys, then help ensure that this valuable public service can continue on KALW by pledging now at 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917, or you can pledge online at KALW.org, KALW.org. And we are entering the last 24 hours of the KALW Fall Membership Drive. And I'm speaking to those of you who've been listening to the drive for the last 2 weeks and you haven't made your pledge yet. You are members of the Last Minute Club. You are the procrastinators who are waiting till the very last minute, the very last day to pledge. Don't wait for tomorrow. Do it now. Show your support and appreciation for Your Legal Rights, for Chuck Finney, for Alice O'Sullivan, for Tony Nieres, talking about the topic of immigration. 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917. And those are some of the sounds from the Burglar Deterrent Home Protection CD. Any burglar who's lurking around your house will sure be fooled into thinking that there are people home when you're out. And I'm sure this will deter many a burglar from breaking in while you're away on vacation or whatever. $75 will get you this Burglar Deterrent Home Protection CD. We only have eight left. 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917. And we're only taking a few moments out of Your Legal Rights to remind you that we need your pledges of support to meet our overall goal, which we hope to reach by tomorrow. But it's only going to happen if you help us out now. 800-525-9917 or make your pledge online at KALW.org. The time is 7:30 on KALW San Francisco. And now we return you to Your Legal Rights and your guest host, Alice O'Sullivan.
Thank you, Joanne. Oh, boy, you convinced me, I'll tell you. That Rover is something else. So, I'm here with Mr. Tony Nieres, who is a member of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, is a specialist in immigration and nationality law certified by the Board of Legal Specialization. His law offices are in Burlingame, and we've been talking, Tony, about the Deferred Action Childhood Arrivals, the DACA program.
Yes, that's correct.
And I want to advise our listeners that you're welcome, if you have a question for Tony Nieres, to call in. The number to call is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Tony Nieres would welcome your call on the DACA program or any other immigration issue that you may have. Tony, when we left off from the first half hour, we were talking about the application that one needs to file to get into this deferred action program. And we were discussing one of the the requirements, as I understand it,
yes,
is that you have physical presence here on June 15th, 2012.
That's correct.
I'm not sure that I could, I was here on June 15th, but I'm not sure how do I go about showing I was here.
Yes. Generally, if you have a document that indicates that on this day you were here, for example, if you had a your school record would indicate that, that you were enrolled in school, that that would certainly be good. You know, June is generally during the summer break,
yes,
in, of school, and so we've had clients who have a little difficulty in trying to establish this. But the idea is that if the person had actually enrolled in summer school, and summer school started maybe June 1st or June 5th, and continued on until August or September or possibly August, then a certification in that regard that he was here for enrolled for summer school, which started June 5th, ended in August 30th or August 25th, then that's sufficient as well.
Okay.
The advice of other people is to try and get documents that indicate presence shortly before that actual June 15th date. In other words, if you had a doctor's appointment or a certification from your dentist saying that you had an appointment on June 10th and the follow-up was 2 weeks later on June 24th, then it would appear that you were here on June 15th during the interval between the two appointments.
Sure.
You know, here, the idea is that if you're able to bring something, to submit something that indicates that you were probably here, I think that the adjudicator would possibly indicate, yes, you were here. It looks from the documents, supporting documents submitted, that it's more likely than not that you were actually here and that you comply with the requirement.
So in order to show then that you're eligible in addition to this, these documents, physical presence on that date,
mm-hmm,
you need your school records, I assume, to show you're either currently in school or you've gotten your high school,
school diploma. That's correct.
You could also show, what if you're in school to get your GED, for example?
Again, a certification saying that you're on the way to obtaining your GED. You know, there's a number from the group that actually makes estimates. They've actually estimated that there's a number of eligible people who are actually lacking this particular requirement, that they either lack a GED or a high school diploma, and or that they're not enrolled in school, but they're otherwise eligible except for that. And then the idea becomes you should enroll in school in order to be able to qualify for this particular program. You should either get into an educational program that would lead to a GED or lead to a high school diploma. And that's the simple matter of getting to that first and then applying for deferred action. There have been advice from immigration attorneys that the best source of schools and institutions that would qualify under this law would be provided by the State Department of Education, for instance.
Sure, I can see that. And it strikes me that there's no requirement that one has been continuously in school or such. So if you dropped out of school, one can get a GED without without a whole lot of foundation.
That's correct. That's correct. And again, the idea is that this is a gateway in order to obtain a job. What do you call this? That's why you'll be needing your employment authorization, which would be issued by this program.
So if you get these documents together, you basically, if you don't have the documents, you can, if you're not in school, if you hadn't been in the service, all of that, enroll in a school.
Yes.
Get your documents together about being here on June 15th, 2012.
That's correct.
You get those documents together, you can get the application and start the process rolling. Am I right about that?
That's correct, Alice. You're absolutely right. What do you call this? You need to complete that application consideration for deferred action. You needed to complete an application for the employment authorization and an actual worksheet for that supports the employment authorization. The laws regarding, the immigration law regarding issuance of employment authorization is that some economic necessity is required. In other words, you have to show that you need to work. But well, in this day and age...
Who doesn't?
<That's>
the 1%, I guess. You are listening to Your Legal Rights with Tony Nieres. I want to give the phone number out for those of you who may have a question for our guest tonight. If you call in, please call 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Tony will be happy to take your questions. It seems to me to be fairly exciting that the applications just taken for a month or so are that you see an imminent approval of those coming. So it doesn't sound like the government is taking a whole lot of time to vet these applications.
Yes, from the administrative perspective, this is something that the government is taking on without actual numbers of personnel to handle an influx of this many applications. In other words, I suspect that because this is a matter of executive fiat, there had been no budgetary outlay for actual administrative costs in handling applications like this. But at the same time, the issue of efficiency and uniformity in the adjudications of these considerations for deferred action is important because effective and uniform adjudications would validate the program, and it would ease the worry or the anxiety or the concerns of the applicants and their families about this program. Ultimately, as well, the numbers will be the fire to propel Congress to actually pass legislation to address this this immigration problem.
And that's clearly what's needed here. So that we don't have this situation where people are in a sort of a limbo of what they can and cannot do, or what benefits they can and cannot get.
That's absolutely right.
But it strikes me that 72,000 is a figure that really speaks well, as you pointed out, the enthusiasm of the students, the willingness of them to want to get out and work. The 72,000 initial applications speaks very well to that. If I'm assuming that if those applications, many of them are approved, then we mentioned earlier that there's over 1 million people, it's thought, eligible to apply.
Yes, that's correct, Alice. It's more than 1 million, about 1,200,000.
I'd like you to explain a little bit about more about this, the numbers, and how important it is, how important the numbers are going to be to the program itself and to Congress and that sort of thing.
Yes, the estimates of I believe it was Migration Policy Institute. They estimated that 1,200,000 individuals are over 15 years of age and thus eligible to apply for deferred action. And then you have another 500,000 that's who will gradually age into the program. In other words, they're probably 14 or 13 years of age, and in 2 years, in a year, they'll be eligible and can apply as well. And this points to the fact that this deferred action for childhood arrivals will address the issue of this particular segment of the undocumented population in order to provide them, because they're a low priority in the enforcement actions of the Immigration Service, then these will provide them an opportunity to work lawfully with the employment authorizations which are issued to them. This points out to the fact, at least in my belief, that this matter had been festering for a while. The Congress knew about it, that they were hoping to do something about it, but they, at the last second almost, they decided not to do anything and just kick the proverbial can down the road. And so, with these estimates, at least the numbers, if you have a growing number of applications which are being submitted and a growing number of applications which are being granted, it's a validation of the seriousness and the extent of the problem. And this will definitely, this should definitely spur the Congress to formulate legislation to fix this broken system, to provide for permanent benefits for this huge population, to give them a pathway to permanent residence and to citizenship, so that so that you diminish this problem, so that the numbers go down, so that more and more persons are integrated into the lawful population of the United States. I mean, this is the only way that you can sort of resolve this problem, by picking on the most promising sector and giving them the benefit.
Yes, yes. There doesn't seem to be a downside to it.
Right. You know, and let me point out that the program specifically disqualifies individuals who have significant criminal history. And so one of the questions that were asked is that, but this guy made one mistake and he's reformed, etc. Shouldn't he be given an opportunity to obtain the same benefits as persons who have been given the benefit under the program? My response always is that in time, but not now. Why? Because we have the priority is this particular segment of society. If you fall out of it, unfortunately, we can't put you in, not at this time.
So that's something that will have to come as later.
At a later time, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What kind of criminal records are we talking about here?
Well, significant misdemeanors. If there are any misdemeanors that involve possession of firearms, sexual abuse, domestic violence, burglary, and what do you call this? Even driving under the influence of drugs or alcohol. This can actually prevent you from obtaining deferred action.
So really, we're talking the cream of the crop here.
That's correct. again, it's very difficult to find a person who would be against this particular segment of the population and tell them, no, you should be deported.
Yes, I can't even envision that myself. But for those of you who have comments on what we've been discussing or questions or concerns about this or another immigration matter, please call. You can reach us at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I'm Alice O'Sullivan, guest host for Chuck Finney. We're talking this evening with Antonio Nieres, who is a member of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, a specialist in immigration and nationality law, certified by the Board of Legal Specialization. His law offices are in Burlingame.
Robert?
Ah, we have a caller. Robert, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Oops. It looks like Robert lost us, or we lost Robert. While we're waiting for Robert to join us or get back on the line, this Social Security card that is given, will that be given when the approval comes in? So for those applicants, for example, who applied on August 15th, will that Social Security card be coming soon after the approval?
Well, everything requires an application. In other words, when the application for deferred action is made, the requirement is that you should also apply for employment authorization. So it's not just, you cannot just ask for a consideration for deferred action. That has to be coupled with an actual application for employment authorization together with the employment authorization worksheet indicating that you have economic necessity to ask for employment authorization. Now, if the deferred action is granted, there would also be a grant of employment authorization. Once the employment authorization is granted, it'll typically come in the form of an identification card with a name, with the applicant's name, picture, and signature, and indicates that he's authorized to accept employment in the United States. And mind you, this is open to any and all employment. After receipt of that card, the applicant herself or himself would have to go to the Social Security Administration to ask for a Social Security card saying that I'm now authorized to work legally here in the United States.
I see.
And I need a Social Security number.
I see.
What do you call this? Parenthetically, since Social Security numbers were, fraudulent Social Security numbers were so rampant previously, the immigration lawyer's advice is really do not give in or do not disclose any fraudulent Social Security numbers that the applicant may have used in the past, because it will create so much problems for the applicant as far as Social Security is concerned.
Sure, good idea, good advice.
So
yes.
The idea now is that you start from scratch, obtain your own Social Security number in your name, and with that go forward as far as making Social Security payments.
That sounds like excellent advice. Robert, welcome back to us. You have a question?
Sorry. I have a question, kind of a general sort. There's been several references to a broken system, and I wonder if we could kind of have a picture of how many people are here without all the right documents and where they come from. And I think most people just think of from south of the border, but they're Irish and all sorts of things. Could you just give a picture of the whole broken system quickly?
How do I start a thousand page novel and condense it for you, Robert. Yeah. The idea really of a broken system is that, for numbers alone, the approximation is about 12 million. Mm-hmm. 12 million individuals all over the United States are not documented. It's either they came here undocumented, in other words, just crossed the border, or like these childhood arrivals, they were brought in possibly by their parents who were also undocumented. A great number of these people would have come in on some lawful visa, for example, a student visa or a visitor's visa. They overstay their authorized stay and just basically become undocumented. There's no lawful status for them to be here in the United States, but they're here.
Mm-hmm.
There's also other people who have come in on valid work visas or exchange visitors visas, and they've actually let those lapse as well, and so that all of those people would fall into a segment of the, I mean, would fall part of the 12 million who are not documented any longer. Students who went to school and decided to stay on without the benefit of renewing their visas or obtaining optional practical training or work authorization pursuant to the grant of their student visas also can fall out of status and become part of that.
Well, it sounds like we were trying to make a start with this deferred action. It was I think you pointed out earlier, a bold step on behalf of the executive, and so it's a good first step. Robert, thank you so much for your call.
Sure.
We have Peter on the phone. Peter?
Yes, I'm wondering, I read recently that the Supreme Court has taken up the state bar's question about certifying or giving a law license to a person who's passed a bar exam but is undocumented, and the issue is that should someone who has broken the law become an attorney. I'm wondering if your guest has any ideas on what arguments that this applicant could make and whether perhaps DACA might help him out.
Well, I believe the actual issue became the moral character requirement of being able to practice law in California. The applicant status became issue by the state bar itself. In other words, the state bar learned of his status and made it an issue. And the question was whether or not he could practice law even if he was out of status. And it's an ongoing controversy. It's before the Supreme Court at this time, and I don't have a sense of where it's going, unfortunately.
Do you know, does this person meet the requirement? Are they below 31 years old?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
If he does, then he's eligible to apply for deferred action, but I don't know whether or not that would suffice for the Supreme Court to allow him to practice.
Yes. Well, that's an interesting question, Peter. Thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome.
And welcome to Your Legal Rights, Reed.
Hi. I have a question about dual citizenship.
Okay.
And whether or not it's possible under American law. I hear from time to time about people who have dual citizenship, but I could provide details regarding a friend of mine who was told when he was offered a job in Austria that he had to become an Austrian citizen, and he did so, but the American, his birth nation, he was born in California, told him that he could not hold dual citizenship and he had to renounce his American citizenship. Is that still the case?
Yeah, well, the American law does not promote dual citizenship. The idea is that your allegiance is divided into two particular nationalities. The practicality of it, however, is that it's a matter of the law of the particular state or country that you come from. For example, if you were Italian and you became an American citizen by naturalization, the question would be whether or not you have lost your Italian citizenship because of your birth. And this will go back to the whole idea of jus soli or jus sanguine, which determines citizenship, whether it's the law of the blood or law of the place where you were born. And it's really a conflict of laws issue.
Reed, thank you for your call. I'm sorry we are out of time. This has been Your Legal Rights. Our guest has been this evening Tony Nieres, who is a member of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, a specialist in immigration and nationality certified by the Board of Legal Specialization, whose offices are in Burlingame. Our program engineer tonight has been Joanne Marr, program assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, Trust and Estate Section, Labor and Employment Section of the State Bar, by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. I'm Alice O'Sullivan, sitting in for Chuck Finney, who is away. Thank you so much, Tony. It's been a very interesting evening.
Thank you, Alice. It has been very interesting.